The Off the Wall podcast comes to you each week on iTunes and YesNetwork.com. If you like what you're listening to, simply subscribe to the show on iTunes. And if you have an extra minute, leave a comment and rating. Welcome to an all-new Off the Wall on YesNetwork.com. Chris Sheeran and Joe Auriemma give their opinions on the latest happenings surrounding Yankees baseball, as well as dive into the hottest topics in the sports world. And now, here are your hosts, Chris Sheeran and Joe Auriemma.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Off the Wall podcast here on YesNetwork.com. Chris Sheeran, Joe Auriemma, and today we have CBS News legal analyst Jack Ford, who also does the Ivy League football broadcast with me on the Yes Network. Jack, thank you for joining us today. We appreciate it.
Chris, always a pleasure to talk to you.
We just want to get involved first and foremost with this scandal at Penn State. We'll also touch on the NBA lockout as well with Mr. Ford from a legal perspective, because, you know, God knows my middle name is Layman. Everything has to be put into the basic terms for me. And I think for, you know, some other people out there also who don't really quite understand all the ins and outs of what's going on with these two situations. But first, let's talk about Penn State. And Jack, you know, you are a former prosecutor, trial lawyer. So I have to ask you this first and foremost. I know we talked about this off camera before the Princeton-Yale game this past weekend, and the prevailing factor that you brought up is that, you know, the whole innocent until proven guilty has to play out here. Now, regardless of what the court of public opinion feels, which is probably guilty across the board, innocent until proven guilty has to shine here, no?
You know, one of the things, you're right, Chris, one of the things I think that we hopefully learned on the heels of the Duke lacrosse case is that, you know, things are not always the way they first appear. Now, look, I don't pretend to know anything more about Jerry Sandusky's case than everybody out there does. You know, there are bits and pieces being released periodically. And does it certainly sound on the surface as if it's really bad? Absolutely. But we're not going to know for a while. You know, my mantra has always been more facts are better than less facts, you know, to help you get a sense of things. As you said, there's a real distinction, though. Innocent until proven guilty applies in a court of law. It's not what people are bound to in the court of public opinion. And you know, people are entitled to their opinions whenever they want to form them. I've always said, but although you're entitled to your own opinion, you're not entitled to your own facts. You know, so the facts are what drive these things. But, you know, I can see why people are looking at Jerry Sandusky and you know, feeling that this is just a horrendous situation. You know, his comments to Bob Costa were kind of strange. I think that where I would have cautioned a little bit more reservation in terms of action is this. I know the university had to do something. But with regard to certainly Joe Paterno and Tim Curley and Gary Schultz and even Graham Spanier, the president of the university, if I was on that board, I'm not so sure I would have said, unless, you know, they maybe know more than has been released, but I'm not so sure I would have said, here's what I think we should do. We should suspend them, put them on administrative leave, and I think we should then bring in some former prosecutor from someplace and let there be an independent examination, because the board shouldn't be doing its own examination. The board may well be a defendant in a bunch of civil cases coming out of here soon.
Well,
you know, it's got a sort of conflict of interest. Let somebody do an independent investigation, and then when all the facts are in, then you decide, do people get fired? Do people get reinstated? You know, are people going to be convicted? Are they going to be exonerated? And then we can move forward.
It seemed to me, Jack, that, and you could correct me if I'm wrong or if this opinion is just outlandish, but it seemed to me that Penn State, Happy Valley, instituted martial law and said, look, we're going to take care of this. We're going to handle it ourselves. And I think the fact that they did that is why they're going through all of this now.
Yeah, that's a very good point, Chris. You know, one of the problems, you know, you can become very insular. And, you know, Penn State is this beautiful campus, and it's a magnificent academic institution, but it's in its own kind of little bubble there in Happy Valley. I think even just the terminology, Happy Valley, gives
right.
you a sense that, you know, it can be insular. That's not necessarily a bad thing all the time. But, you know, I think a lot of people share that same sense that you have, which is, in this instance, you know, they're it seems as if they're saying we can take care of anything within our own walls here. We can handle this. You know, we don't need to go outside the walls to get this resolved. And you know, there are a lot of legitimate questions being raised about, you know, why didn't you go to police, to law enforcement authorities? And, you know, let's let everybody handle these investigations rather than you all just being willing to say, yeah, we've looked at it. We don't think there's enough. We're done. You know, make this thing go away. So I think that's a very good criticism. And I think with the clarity of hindsight, they're probably realizing that too. But, you know, it's a danger. You just got to be careful that you're not so myopic in your existence that you become convinced that, you know, we can handle everything ourselves.
Let me ask you this, Jack. Put yourself in the defense attorney's shoes right now.
Mm-hmm.
How does your client, Sandusky, get a fair trial? I mean, with everything that's out there and the media saturation,
yeah,
how difficult is it to get a jury of his peers,
yeah,
to give him a fair trial?
Yeah. Well, the first thing you got to do is you got to get this trial out of the State College, Pennsylvania vicinity. You know, the first thing you do is you move for a change of venue. Now, look, a lot of people might say, who hasn't heard about this? And they're probably correct. But it surprises a lot of people that to get a fair juror, it doesn't disqualify somebody if they say, I know about the case. You know, a lot of people think, well, if you know about it, you can't sit on the jury. You can say, I know about the case. You can say, I've seen newspaper reports, I've seen television reports about it, I've been online and I've read about it. You can still sit as a juror as long as the court and both sets of lawyers are satisfied that you haven't irretrievably made up your mind. So if you go in there and say, look, I've listened to the stories, I've heard the stories, I'm not sure what happened here. And ultimately you say, I think I haven't decided, I can be fair about this. You can be a juror. But I think it would be important because so many people are connected to Penn State in that area.
Right.
Economically connected, emotionally connected.
And not
only... I think you've got to move that to someplace else in the state of Pennsylvania. Will it make a big difference? I don't know, but it might make a difference.
Not only Penn State, but to the Second Mile charity. Judge,
sure,
Leslie Dutchcott was a volunteer,
yeah,
for,
yeah,
the Second Mile charity.
Many interconnections here.
Would you push for her to be recused? I mean, is that something a prosecutor,
yeah,
can do
in
the case?
Usually what happens with this, Chris, is the first judge that handles the bail is not often, probably in most cases, is not the one that's going to handle the trial. Usually you have somebody who's on sort of bail duty, they call it, and if something comes in, they handle it. Now, sometimes they can be the one to stay with it. My guess would be, given the relationships here, that there would be no inclination on the part of the court system to have somebody presiding over this who has had any connection to this. So I think you're going to see a change in that, you know, fairly soon down the road. I think the next time they're going to be in court, you're probably going to see a different judge on the bench.
Legally, Jack, does Joe Paterno have anything negative to look forward to in his future? Did he do everything legally correct, or can he be found liable of something in the future?
Well, again, another good question. You have sort of two parallel areas here for them to be concerned about. One is any criminal charges, and the other is civil responsibility, civil lawsuits. On the criminal end of things, now the Attorney General has said, we are not looking to charge Joe Paterno with anything. But that's a little bit puzzling if you look at, the surface of this, because Joe Paterno apparently said the same thing to the grand jury that Tim Curley said and that Gary Schultz said, which is all we knew, we didn't know about the allegation of a brutal rape. We were told about what might have been inappropriate horsing around in the shower, okay? Tim Curley says that in the grand jury. He gets indicted for perjury, the theory being that he was told more than that. Gary Schultz says it in the grand jury. He gets indicted for perjury, the allegations being that he was told more than that. Joe Paterno says the same thing, and the grand jury doesn't get indicted. And you know, you have to wonder, and I'm not advocating that he should be. I'm not advocating that any of them should be. But observations have been made saying, why did these other two guys get indicted, and they don't? You know, full disclosure, Christian, and you know this, I know Joe Paterno. I've introduced him at dinners. I've sat next to him. He actually put in a phone call to see if I was interested in playing for Penn State when I was coming out of high school. Tim Curley, I would consider a friend. I've sat with him at games and you know, talked with him. Graham Spanier, I've met a couple of times. So, you know, I know and respect these guys, which has sort of made it difficult, you know, for me a lot in reporting on this. But so Joe Paterno, they have said no criminal exposure. We're not looking for him. Civilly is a different situation. I'm sure you're going to see lawsuits that are going to be directed at, of course, Jerry Sandusky, for the actual allegations of conduct here. And you'll see lawsuits that will go to all the individuals named, Joe Paterno, Tim Curley, Gary Schultz, Graham Spanier, and the university. And the claim for that is going to be, you know, the law says essentially if you're an employer, and you're an employee, your employee is doing something wrong within the confines of their employment, you can be held, can be held responsible, equally responsible for their conduct. Now, there are all sorts of exceptions, and it's a law school class. We don't need to get into all the details here. But the bottom line is, I'm sure you're going to see lawsuits saying that the university and these individuals either knew or should have known what was going on and didn't, and were negligent in their failure and maybe willful misconduct in their failure to do anything about this. So you're going to see a whole docket load, Chris, of lawsuits floating out of this thing.
Hi, Jack. How are you? It's Joe Auriemma.
Hey, Joe. How are you?
Good, good. And again, Jack Ford is with us. He's a CBS News legal analyst. And Jack, you just mentioned, you know, this is going to be the fallout at Penn State now. We're going to see a lot of different things going on the legal side of things. My question to you is, how long is this process going to take between the Sandusky trial and all of the civil lawsuits that really could put a dark cloud over this Penn State campus and this Penn State University?
Well, the sad thing, Joe, the sad answer is you're talking about years here, not weeks, not months, years. Criminal case such as this, invariably you'd be talking about somewhere, you know, generally within a year, might even be longer, depending upon how complicated it gets, what their docket is. Civil suits always take much longer. You know,
right.
we basically said criminal cases more important for us to get them done quickly because, you know, literally sometimes lives are on the line. Civil suits, not to minimize them, but civil suits generally are about money damages.
Right.
So that distinction is important. So a civil suit could take anywhere from 1 to sometimes 3-4 years before you actually get to trial if you don't get resolved. Now, the reality is the vast majority of civil suits get settled. I think, you know, 90-some percent of civil suits get settled. The corresponding vast majority of criminal cases get pled out in some fashion. You know, less than 10% of criminal cases actually go to trial. So, you know, there's always, if you look at statistically, chances of these cases getting resolved without having to go to trial are pretty high. But if they don't, and you're talking about stretching it out until it's time to go to trial, yeah, you know, look at the Casey Anthony case just took place in Florida. It took 3 years for
right.
that to go to trial. Now, there were a lot of extraordinary circumstances. But the point is, Joe, you're talking about years here, not months.
Now, Jack, there is a story that came out today that said that in July, Joe Paterno essentially put his house in his wife's name, selling the house for a dollar, obviously, moving the name over. So, is that a sign to you that, you know, Joe Paterno, with the civil cases that possibly could come up, was already preparing for this back in July?
Well, you know, it could be. It could be two things, really. I mean it could be some other possibilities. But one is it could be a simple estate planning measure.
Right.
Where, you know, Joe is getting older and you know, he might be following advice of an estate planner or an estate attorney. Saying, you know, let's do some things here with your estate in anticipation of whatever's going to happen to you down the road. So it could be perfectly innocent.
Right.
But it also could be a situation where, you know, if somebody came to me as an attorney and said, look, I'm looking at the possibility of some lawsuits down the road. I think I'm fine. I don't think I did anything wrong, but I think there might be coming. You know, one of the things you certainly say to him is, let's see how we can protect your assets here. Now, the law allows, if there is, I'm not talking about Joe Paterno's case, so let's just talk about any type of a case, hypothetical
right.
case, and if somebody claims, somebody has a lawsuit against somebody, they get a judgment, and it turns out they have no assets left because they've transferred them all, the law allows you to sort of delve into those transfers and see if they were really a sham in order to avoid creditors. And if that happens, sometimes they can invalidate those transfers. Again, I'm not saying that this is what this was. Just saying, hypothetically, that's what the law sometimes allows. But, you know, it's certainly curious. It could be something that's entirely innocuous, or it could be something in anticipation of litigation. We don't know.
Moving on to Jerry Sandusky now. From a legal perspective, Jerry Sandusky's attorney was on Rock Center with Bob Costas, and basically they got Jerry Sandusky on the phone. And I feel like that interview did not help Jerry Sandusky's case. Do you think that it was a really bad move on the defense team's part to have Jerry Sandusky exposed, really without any knowledge of what Bob Costas was going to ask, and kind of putting him on the spot like that in that much of a national scene?
You know, it was pretty bizarre, Joe, for a couple of reasons. Generally speaking, criminal defense lawyers do not like their clients to talk. You know, generally speaking, if you're a criminal defense lawyer, you want to control everything you can possibly control.
Right.
Once your client starts talking, you've lost control. Now, maybe you've prepared the client and you've set up a script, and, you know, it may well be, I mean, that sometimes what you do want that to happen is if you have a client and you believe that they're absolutely innocent and you believe that they have a compelling story to tell and you say to yourself, you know what, we need to get some publicity ourselves out here. I'm comfortable with my client talking. I'm comfortable with what they have to say. Let's get out there. You know, let's see if we can combat this a little bit. That's the reason why you would sometimes let your client talk.
Right.
Because remember, you know, when we see in the TV shows when the cops are throwing the handcuffs on the guy and they've got him up against the car and they say, you know, anything you say can and will be used against you, that
right.
doesn't mean just when you're being interrogated by police officers. Anything a criminal defendant says anywhere, including a conversation with Bob Costas, can be used against them at some point in time. So generally speaking, you're cautious about doing that. Here's what I think happened. My sense is that the defense probably looked at this and said, we're getting clobbered out there. You know, there is nobody out there that doesn't look at Jerry Sandusky as a despicable monster right now.
Right.
What can we do about it? You know, and they're playing to what might be potential jurors out there down the road who are watching and listening. You know, and you're thinking, okay, all they're hearing is the bad stuff. Let's at least get some plausible explanation out there. Will it sound awkward? Yes. But can we present something that's non-criminal? Maybe, as I said, maybe awkward and maybe it doesn't pass the yuck factor, but can we get something out there? And my guess is that's why they decided to do this, to get his story, which is, I'm not a criminal, despite what you think, I'm not a pervert. But this is what I was doing and, you know, why I was doing it. Now, again,
right.
some people came away from that, Joe, saying this didn't help this guy at all. You know, one of the things you talk about, and you know, I'm not saying this specifically about Jerry Sandusky, I don't know, but I remember when I was a prosecutor, I was talking to a psychiatrist about, you know, pedophiles. And he said to me, you can't look at their conduct and examine it under a rational scope. Because, you know, sadly, the people who are pedophiles are wired differently, this guy said to me.
Wow.
You know, the magic words when you're talking about them in terms of treatment, you know, if you're convicted of something, pedophilia, you know, assaulting young children, and you go to an institution, the magic words are compulsive and repetitive. And that's what they're trying to deal with when they're trying to treat somebody like this. So, you know, did Jerry Sandusky help himself? That remains to be seen. Certainly, did he get his version out there? Yes. Was it effective? Who knows?
Right. Jack, are you a little bit surprised that the judge set the bond so low that it was a $100,000 bond, that essentially this guy is still walking around Happy Valley? He was seen at sporting goods stores just a couple of days ago, out in public wearing Penn State attire. Is it a little surprising to you that the number was set so low?
Well, not surprising that he's still out. Here's, again, you know, sometimes people think that bail is a sort of a head start on sentencing, you know, where you get somebody in jail early on. It isn't. That bail, the purpose of bail is to make sure you show up for your trial. That's it. It's nothing more than that, and that's why people sometimes are surprised when somebody charged with a serious crime is allowed to be released on bail. Now, there's some crimes where, you know, if you're a serial murderer, the statutes in most states provide that you don't get bail. Capital case, you don't get bail, you know, when you're looking at the death penalty. But in all other cases, you're supposed to be entitled to some combination of circumstances, bail situations, that would guarantee both that you show up and the safety and security of the public. So that's what the judge has to take into consideration. One of the primary things is, again, will you show up? And they look to your ties to the community. You know, if you're a drifter, and you've got no home and you're passing through and you commit a crime, chances are you're not going to get a low bail number because they're going to say, you know, we're going to lose. As soon as you walk out the door, you're gone. But if you're a guy like Jerry Sandusky, if I'm his lawyer, I'm saying, look, he's been here all of his adult life, essentially. His home is here. His family is here. His connections are here. His bank accounts are here. Everything is here. He's not going anywhere, and he has a vested interest in clearing his name. So because of all those things, and that's generally accepted law, not surprised that he's out on bail, I was surprised that it seemed to be kind of a low, here, sign your name and go home kind of situation. Because, you know, part of it has to reflect the severity of the allegations. Remember, there's still allegations, haven't been proven. So I'm not surprised he's out. I am surprised that it seemed to be a kind of a, yeah, here, sign and go kind of deal. You know what I mean?
Jack Ford, CBS News legal analyst, former prosecutor and also a former trial lawyer, joining us here on the Off the Wall podcast. Jack, one more for me on this, and it has to deal with Mike McQuarrie. This also just coming out as well, an email that was leaked out. He said he did stop what was going on back in 2002, not physically, but made sure it was stopped when I left that locker room, quote unquote. No one can imagine my thoughts or wants to be in my shoes for those 30 to 45 seconds. I can't say I disagree with him there. He did have discussions with police, he said, and with the official at the university in charge of police after the alleged incident involving Sandusky. Now, Jack, let's put you in a prosecutor's shoes now. McQuarrie, in the grand jury testimony, did not say he contacted police. So this contradiction here, does that knock his credibility down that he didn't say, or was he just not asked specifically by the grand jury about the police that day? I mean, there's a fine line between, okay, is this guy switching his story? Is he flip-flopping, or is he telling the truth now, or was he telling the truth at the grand jury?
Yeah.
What does that put the prosecutor – what kind of situation does that put you in?
It's a good question, and here's the answer. McQuarrie was in there as a cooperating witness, right? In other words, you can be – there's several categories in a criminal investigation. You can be simply a witness. Basically, I saw something, here's what I saw, here's what I heard. You can be a subject of a criminal investigation, which means we're not so sure about you right now. We're not so sure where you fit in this mix. Or you can be the target of an investigation, Jerry Sandusky, for instance, or some of the other guys. Mike McQuarrie comes in, by all accounts, as a cooperating witness. You know, he's talked with the prosecution. They've said to him, you have no criminal exposure here. We're not looking for you. We think you're just a witness. You're an important witness for us, and that's why we're going to use you. Prosecutors don't put everything in front of a grand jury.
Okay.
All you put in front of a grand jury as a prosecutor is the most you need to get an indictment. And remember, it's very different grand jury, a little law school lecture here. To convict somebody of a crime in the trial, you need to prove their guilt beyond a reasonable doubt.
Right.
That's the highest standard in the law. At a grand jury proceeding, all you need to do is essentially show these grand jurors evidence that it appears as if a crime was committed and it appears that this person might have something to do with it.
Okay.
It's probable cause to believe it happened and this guy was involved. Much lower standard. As a result, prosecutors are usually very tight to the vest in your presentation to a grand jury. Most times, you don't even use all your witnesses. You just use an investigator because the hearsay rules and that stuff don't apply. So most times, prosecutors, I did it when I was a prosecutor, you bring in your chief investigator. Who'd you talk to? I talked to A, B, and C. What'd they tell you? They told me this, this, and that. And then you say to the grand jury, that's enough. Then here's what we're presenting to you. We'd like you to vote on whether there's sufficient evidence to indict this guy. So the fact that anybody, Mike McQuarrie or any of the people in the grand jury, didn't say everything that they know about this case, is not a problem. And it's certainly if you're the prosecutor, you just want to get as much as you need out there. So, I had said early on when this was happening, we need to give Mike McQuarrie a little bit of a break here because he hasn't been able to tell his story. Remember, everybody was condemning him, or I shouldn't say, but a lot of people condemning him saying, oh my God, how could he not have stopped something? Well, we hadn't heard whether he did or not. Now we're hearing that he did, which, is kind of not surprising. I think just about anybody would do something, even if they stand there and watch and
right. It did seem weird, right?
Yeah. So we're hearing now, and it may well be from what we're hearing now that he did everything he should have done, including stopping it, going to his boss, going to law enforcement people right away. If that's in fact so, then this guy really is becoming kind of a sacrificial lamb of this thing. Here's somebody who got in a situation that he had nothing to do with, did everything he should have done, and now he's also off the field.
And if that's so, you're also looking, this is just speculation on my part, but it's also looking to, Penn State and all of their officials picking up a gigantic, Nittany Lion navy blue rug and sweeping all of this underneath it and saying we can do this ourselves and we're not going to tarnish this Penn State football tradition here.
That's a good analogy. The navy blue rug and everything goes underneath it. You're right.
And there's two unfortunate parties in all of this because unfortunately the victims aren't getting talked about as much as they should, and also the current players, Jack. I mean, there was talk, there was speculation that the last two games of the season were going to be canceled. why in the world would you punish the players on this team who have absolutely nothing to do with anything that's going on?
These players, a lot of them were 10 years old themselves when all of this
happened. Right, and you know, this is, I'm asking a former Division I football player here. Jack played for Yale. He was a defensive back in the late 60s. Sorry to date you there, Jack. But, and he was a heck of a defensive back in the Ivy League. But you have to look at this and say, you know, there are seniors, and you know how hard you work those 4 years to get to your senior season. And there were even a couple reporters saying that, you know, senior day should have been canceled. I mean, how can you do that to these kids? You just can't.
Yeah, and I think you're getting a lot of knee-jerk reactions from folks. And certainly you need to understand, you know, these the alleged victims and what they've gone through. And that's going to be handled. But, you know, I agree with you. It doesn't mean that you have to, of necessity, condemn this entire university for the alleged actions of a few.
Right.
And I was glad to see, you know, I saw some of these cries saying, you know, cancel the rest of the season, cancel senior day. You know, I think fairly short-sighted and not at all productive to do that. And I was very happy to see that they, you know, that they're not penalizing people who are absolutely innocent, even more so than this whole cloud settling over them has done.
Well, Jack, we could talk about this for days, hours, months, but I said we were going to talk about the NBA. So just let me ask you one question about this NBA lockout that's going on. Just try to explain to me, in the simplest way you can, so I can understand it, the decertification of the union. What does that mean? Where are they headed? And do you think that there'll be a season this year?
Yeah, it's a complicated thing. You know, labor law, antitrust law, very complex. But very simply, here's what happens.
Okay.
If you have a union representing a group, such as the NBA players here, and they negotiate an employment agreement, that allows you essentially to go around what would otherwise be an antitrust violation. For instance, if I'm an employer and I've got a business and I go to you and you've got a similar business and we say to each other, you know what, let's agree that we're not going to pay our employees any more than X amount of dollars.
Okay.
Okay? And we're not going to charge any less than X amount of dollars for our products. All right? You and I have just committed a couple of antitrust violations because we have agreed, we've acting in concert to restrain trade in some fashion. But if I am an employer and I own, you know, one of the NBA teams, and together we negotiate with a union, and one of the things we agree to is we're not going to pay people more than X amount of dollars, we won't pay them less than X amount of dollars, this is how everybody gets, you know, this, we're going to have a draft where you don't have a choice what team you're going to play for.
Right.
You're going to play for the team that drafted you. All of that would be an antitrust violation, except for the fact that we bargained for it now. Okay, so that's the importance of a union.
So the collective bargaining agreement.
Yeah, collective bargaining agreement allows you to do what you couldn't do without a union, without creating antitrust violations,
right,
restraint of trade. So now when the players say the union no longer, we no longer have a union, right? Their argument, the players' argument, is going to be, therefore, you, the NBA,
the antitrust violations,
right,
start.
They're saying you must now. But, yeah, exactly. You must.
3 minutes, and Jack Ford has explained it to me.
Yeah, you're good, Chris. But now they're saying you must now negotiate with us individually. You can't keep us from earning a living here because that would be an antitrust violation, among other things, in restraint of trade. So their claim is now every single player should be entitled to go to every NBA team and say, I want to play for you, or I've already got a contract with you. That's valid. I want to play for you. Pay me X amount of dollars. Doesn't make any difference what you're paying anybody else. Let me make a living here. So that's what their argument, that's what they're trying to do here. Now, we saw with the NFL, that didn't work because the court said, essentially, this is a sham. You're making this union go away, not because you really want this union to go away. This union will be right back as soon as this thing gets settled.
Mm-hmm.
So the courts said, they sided with the NFL, and it'll be a little bit of a danger for the NBA here. The court said, this is a charade. So we're going to allow this to continue, the lockout to continue, and we're not going to hold.
Well, what if the same thing happens with the NBA and the courts rule in the NBA's favor? I mean, what happens to the players then?
Well, first of all, it's going to be a long process because
right,
you'll get a first ruling by a judge, as you got initially with the NFL, if you remember, on an early stage here, an injunction. And then that ruling was was appealed to another appellate court. This is even before you ever got to a trial. So you're talking about if the NBA players decide to go the legal route, you know, it's coming back to what we said before about the civil suits in Penn State. There's no way you're going to get a season anytime now. You're going to be, this thing is going to stretch out for years, you know, assuming there are different types of decisions here. I mean, is there a potential that you could get, the NBA players could get a court and an appellate court to agree with them? Sure, there's a potential. I'd be surprised if it happens. So, you know, sometimes I think, you know, when you talk about the idea of let's just blow up the union and proceed with this legally, that's never a good sign in terms for the fans in
right.
terms of ever getting something back up and running soon.
But if the ruling goes in favor of the players, mm-hmm. what does that mean? The season will come back?
Yeah, it's possible. Here's
but you're saying the process is like just entirely too long.
The best case scenario, players they try and get an injunction to keep the teams from locking them out. A judge says yes, the teams can't lock you out anymore. You're not a union. They have to deal with you. That gets appealed. The appellate court agrees. You have to open up. You know, there's a chance that they could be compelled, the NBA could be compelled to open up and to start hiring guys and start playing games. I mean, it's certainly a possibility. Is it a likely one? I think most experts would say it's hard to call.
Okay. Jack, thank you very much. Appreciate it. I have one more question for you.
Yes, I'm sure this is going to be one of the more important ones.
It is. This Saturday.
I know where you were going with this.
The 128th edition of The Game will be played in New Haven at the Yale Bowl between your Bulldogs and the Harvard Crimson. Can I get a prediction, or do you want to just shy away? And
No. I can, as I said to you after we finished our Princeton game broadcast.
I wish we were doing the game this week.
I wish we were doing it, too. That's because, you know what, it'd be a great one to do, and you guys and the team from YES just do a marvelous job with
it. Well, you do, too. You make our job a hell of a lot easier.
Of objectivity, and I'm going to say 21-17 Yale.
Okay.
That was a surprise for you, huh?
All right, and you know, If people don't follow Ivy League football, which a lot of people probably don't, and you should because, you know, in the mighty oak tree that is college football, the Ivy League are the very strong roots that hold this oak tree that is college football up. Harvard is going for an undefeated season in the Ivy League, and it's Jack's Yale Bulldogs that could actually put the kibosh. They've already won the outright title.
Right.
But, you know, believe me when I tell you, and Jack will back this up, if Yale has a chance to ruin a undefeated Ivy League season, they're going to do whatever they can to do it.
It would make the boys' season up at New Haven, Chris.
All right, Jack. We really appreciate you coming on. We really appreciate it. It's CBS News legal analyst Jack Ford. Thank you for hopping aboard. We really appreciate you coming on the podcast.
It's a pleasure, Chris. You be well. Take care.
All right. Take care, Jack.